We live in a world which is orderly and intelligible because it has a rational creator. It actually means it's fully natural for Christians to study science. It's a fully legitimate Christian endeavor. And it can help Christians relax about science, and it can sometimes open up people who aren't Christian to considering Christian faith as well.
You're listening
to the Thinking Matters podcast.
Conversations
at the intersection of
faith,
culture,
and reason.
I'm your host, Todd Funk, and today I'm joined by Dr. Zachary Ardern. Zach, welcome to the show. Zach or Zachary, which is better for you?
I'd say both. It's great. It's great to be here, Todd. Thanks.
Good. For those of you who don't know, Zach is an evolutionary biologist. He earned his PhD in experimental evolution. I had to Google that at the University of Auckland. Basically, microorganisms evolving in real time, I think. He's worked as a postdoctoral research fellow at Wellcome Sanger Institute in Cambridge, previously done some research at KIT and TUM in Germany, and he's got a lot of background in his bachelor's degrees, philosophy, economics, and biology. So he'll be quite well-rounded coming to us today. So Zach, tell me a little bit about, first of all, your journey as a Christian. How and when did you first come to Christ?
Yes, I was raised in a Christian family and had to think about it particularly carefully as a teenager. So a lot of my friends were atheists, probably most of them. And so that's, I think, when I started to take my faith seriously and realized I needed to make a decision for myself, particularly at an Easter camp in Hamilton at the age of 16. So I had some really good Christian friends at high school that was influential on me. And I guess as soon as I became a Christian, I started reading some apologetics related things and thinking, because my friends were skeptical and I had to kind of work out, do I really think this is true? And how does what I believe fit in with what other people believe?
Yeah.
And not too long after that, I went to a Thinking Matters event, back in 2009 or something.
Okay, that was where Thinking Matters was founded, I think. Yeah.
That's right. That's right. So I've been around Thinking Matters for quite a long time.
And you've done a few talks for us, haven't you, at the conferences?
That's right, yeah, in some early days when I was in New Zealand.
Yeah, I thought so. And I'd heard your name around. I think you were with Thinking Matters or did stuff with and through them before I kind of got in the picture. I've only been with them, I don't know, maybe 10 years, I'm not sure, so long. So tell me about the ministry work. I've kind of Googled you and spied on you a bit online, and it says that you and your wife, Anke, is that her name?
Anke, that's right.
Anke, so she's German. What kind of ministry work do you guys do?
She's Dutch, but we met in German. We met in Germany. So we're both active scientists is our day job. But
biology. What's she in?
Astronomy.
Okay. So you've got double bases covered.
That's right.
Cosmological arguments in biology.
Yeah, so my stuff is molecular biology. Hers is galactic astronomy. So kind of opposite ends of the size scale, I guess.
Yeah.
Sometimes we get invitations to speak for Christian student groups or for churches or for Christian academic groups. So just this last weekend, we were in Munich, where I used to work, and we were speaking to a group of Christian postgrads and academics about the relationship between science and faith. I've had a couple of opportunities to speak in skeptics groups, like skeptics in the pub in New Zealand and in the UK. And I like doing discussions with hostile audiences. Can be quite interesting sometimes.
Okay.
Yeah. It's been a while since I've done that. But.
Yeah. And you're in the UK currently, right?
That's right. So we're in Cambridge.
In Cambridge. Yeah. Very good. And outside of ministry and outside of work, what do you enjoy? Would you have any hobbies or interests that you and Anke do? I know I messed that up.
No, it's good. We don't have that much time outside of work and apologetics related things. I enjoy reading, enjoy some time in nature when I get the chance, which should be more often.
Yeah.
And we're able to travel a bit through work. So that's, I guess, a benefit is to go to conferences in interesting places and meet interesting people.
Yeah. Do you get opportunity to see the great outdoors like you would have in New Zealand?
So not as much.
Walks there. No, I wouldn't imagine. Yeah. Yeah. Zach, would it be fair to say that you're an evolutionary creationist or a theistic evolutionist when it comes to your position on human origins or biological origins?
Yeah, broadly, I think that's okay. I mean, my position has shifted over the years. I guess I wouldn't usually use that label because it's just such a broad category.
What has been your journey? You said you've shifted. Where'd you come from with your belief in origins and age of the earth and all that kind of stuff to where you are now?
Sure. So I guess as a teenager, I kind of switched between young earth creationism and old earth creationism of some kind. In a church context, sometimes I guess I was taught young earth creationism quite clearly, but as I got older as a teenager and studied some science and read some Christian apologetics from William Lane Craig and others, I kind of shifted to an old earth position. In my first year of university, I actually almost shifted back to a young earth position because of the hostility from the biology lecturers who were critiquing creationism, but critiquing it quite badly. That kind of pushed me into reading a lot of creationist material and almost shifted me back. But then I kind of, over the course of my biology degree, I guess settled into some kind of old earth developmental position. And I guess increasingly saw what I see as the evidence for common descent or common ancestry and evolutionary processes. So I guess I shifted towards something like a theistic evolution view, but my view is different from some theistic evolutionists in that I am happy talking about design. So I think we'll say more
about that. I mean, because I was going to say, how do you reconcile the paradox of an omniscient God who's sovereignly in control of everything with biology is often defined or explained in the textbooks as a random, unguided process. I mean, how did you reconcile that, or how do you?
Yeah, so a lot of scientific processes are described as stochastic or random in a technical scientific sense. So when we roll the dice in a board game, we might, it's in some sense a random process, but it's also a process that God knows the outcome of. I think it's one of the proverbs. I think it's Proverbs 16, but I probably got that reference wrong. They've got basically says that though you roll the dice, God knows the outcome. So God is God's knowledge isn't threatened by processes which are in some sense stochastic or able to be modeled probabilistically. So I'm not worried by the so-called randomness of evolution. I don't think that's really a theological problem.
Do you think it's like, I mean, people say, did God chose you before the foundation? Yes. Is there an element of your choosing him? Yes. Both scriptures seem to be true at the same time. Paradoxical to us, but not to God. Would you classify that kind of in the same camp? While it might seem completely random to us, God is hidden behind the chance?
Yeah, I think there's less of a paradox here. So Christians often pray about the weather or pray about natural events, and we can still study meteorology and still study natural processes, and that's kind of modeled through chaos theory, which has like a lot of kind of stochasticity or so-called randomness in it. So I think we're used to natural processes being and unpredictable to us, but still fully predictable to God. My position is actually a little stronger than that. I think there's actually hints of design in the evolutionary process. So this is where I differ from a lot of theistic evolutionists.
So what do you think of the intelligent design camp and Stephen Meyer's Signature in the Cell? I mean, when I read that, I thought, man, this is so logical and it makes so much sense. How could anyone push back against it? Do you have sympathy towards the ID camp and Myers?
So I used to be more sympathetic than I am now on a scientific level. So I had a discussion for an event in Cambridge with Stephen Meyer maybe a couple of months ago. Now, and I've had various discussions with various intelligent design people over the years, like Michael Behe and various others. But I'm less sympathetic than I used to be because I think they make some specific empirical claims that I'm just not so sure about. So like the probability of obtaining a protein, a folded protein, is often quoted as something that 1 in 10 to the 77 based on
Doug Axe's
work. Exactly. So this stuff gets very technical. It's related to some of my current research, but one of the main points here is that it really depends on the size of the protein. So if you're talking about 150 amino acids, I think that might be the size of the domain they typically talk about.
Yeah.
It's quite improbable, but actually the mini proteins are much smaller than that. And the standard evolutionary picture would be that proteins tend to start much smaller. So if we're talking about the origin of a protein, it's not really fair to the evolutionary kind of paradigm to assume that it has to start as, say, 150 or 300 amino acids or such.
Isn't it kind of a special pleading to say, well, because we know evolution is true, we know they must have started with smaller proteins, although we don't find them in nature?
So that's not my argument. Special pleading in that. So there's many smaller proteins in nature. The kind of minimal size for protein domain is 30 to 40 amino acids. That's long enough to get a small folded domain. And in fact, if we try and look at the proteins which look like they are the youngest in evolutionary history, as in they're restricted to just a few species, they actually turn out to be the smaller ones. So there's a very clear trend across evolution that proteins are born small and become longer over time. And this is actually something that it might seem very theoretical, or something which someone who rejects evolution doesn't need to worry about. But I would say that basically everyone accepts some kind of evolution. So most people who reject evolution would still typically accept that, say, a mouse and a rat, so a house mouse and a rat, are actually related. So they're both in the genus. No, that's not right. They're in the same family, which is Muridae. I might be getting this wrong off the top of my head. My research is bacteria, not Muridae.
Right.
But the point is the same taxonomic family. And most people, including young Earth creationists, would say that they're actually related to each other. But there's a lot of differences between the mouse genome and the rat genome. And even at this kind of level, you can see that some proteins are restricted to a single species or a single genus, which implies that they arose relatively recently. And these kind of trends we can do and show that basically there's a general rule that the very young proteins, those that look like they arose recently, are actually quite small. And we don't see these kind of longer proteins of multiple hundreds of amino acids popping out of nothing.
Well, what would Axe's statistics have looked like had he used a protein of 30 amino acids? Have you ever toyed with that just for the fun of it? Because we know we scientific people kind of have a weird sense of fun.
Yeah, so it really depends what kind of thing that protein is doing. And there's not that much experimental data on this kind of question. But it is very clear that the number is much... it's much easier to get that kind of protein, but it depends on the function and such. But it's my understanding is that it's within the range of what you'd expect. It might be 1 in 10 to the 20, maybe something along those lines, which is actually within what's feasible for evolution research.
I've always wanted to ask a theistic evolutionist is. To accept 1 in 10 to the 20 as, it's possible, therefore probable, therefore is going to happen. I mean, you didn't say that, but do you have to kind of drunk the Kool-Aid, Zach, to take a number like that as not being staggeringly, staggeringly unrealistic for having to happen, not just once, but having to happen multiple times to get, you know, a protein to do what it needs to do or whatever?
No, sorry. I disagree. So population sizes are quite large. So population sizes of bacteria are, again, I'm going off the top of my head, but they're on the order of 10 to the 10 or something like this. Viruses are presumably larger, or at least their generation time is so short that viruses are amazing. How much evolutionary space they explore. So I actually think viruses, and this is kind of my own kind of pet hypothesis, I guess, and somewhat controversial, but I think viruses are evolutionary machines that explore a lot of sequence space. They a lot of new proteins get created in viruses and then actually get inserted into bacteria or into other organisms. And you can actually trace this, I think, quite confidently. You can really see that this protein clearly came from a virus. And I think that's one really interesting and quite nicely designed way in which new proteins are introduced into complex, more complex organisms. Like a virus isn't an organism, but it is still able to explore protein space. And right. Bacteria also, well, this is actually less clear, but bacteria also seem to invent new genes in various different ways. Sometimes it's from scratch, but often it's from combining genes together. It's like merging genes, fusing genes, and then you actually get a slightly different structure. And that's one way in which new genes are created. Yeah. So this is a whole research field of how new genes get created. And I could talk and write for a long time about this, but the basic idea is I just disagree empirically with some of the intelligent design claims in this kind of area.
Go ahead.
Oh, I just think it's interesting. They're asking some good questions that a lot of kind of standard evolutionary biology hasn't answered until relatively recently, or hasn't been able to answer because we didn't have the data. But I think the more one looks into it, the more I think one can see traces of ancestry whenever you look at a biological function or organ or organelle or protein. They're not just popping out of nowhere fully formed.
Well, and you, from a Christian believer perspective, you must be acutely aware of bias and the lens we're looking through. In other words, I read that you said that the young earth creationists, anybody with a credible degree in the right area, if they hold that, they invariably are looking through the lens of just a young earth literal Genesis reading, something like that, Zach. But could you be accused of the same thing that well, of course, if two things are similar in different organisms, because they evolved as opposed to the creationist argument might say, well, it's because they have a common designer and creator, like a painter type thing. I mean, did I even ask a question in that, or was I rambling?
No. That, I mean, it's a common response that, well, the same pattern of biological similarity could be explained by common design rather than common ancestry or common descent. I think the difficulty is that common design could explain anything, but that doesn't mean that there's no evidence from the patterns that we see. So if two of my students, when I'm marking their essays, hand in basically the same essay, and I know that they work... common, you know, they're both intelligent agents. They could have designed it to be exactly the same, but there's a natural explanation, which is copying. And I think whenever we see these kind of long strings of information, they're very similar to each other. It's natural to think of them as copying, and particularly in the case of DNA, which is the molecule of inheritance. If someone has a paternity test or someone sends their DNA to the company, I can't remember the name of it, 23. You know, there's companies that will sequence your DNA and report your DNA, and you can discover your long lost cousins or cousins three times removed or such. And that's because DNA is the molecule of inheritance. So similarity in DNA is evidence.
.com, I think my wife has done it. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I think there's a few of these, so similarity in DNA is taken on the small scale to be similarity in relationship or like close relationship. And when we see the same patterns at kind of a slightly larger scale, say between the mouse and the rat, even the young earth creationist will say that these are related. And you can extrapolate backwards. And I just don't see a good place to do the kind of chopping off to say, okay, that even though they have the same pattern of similarity, they're actually not related by descent, but they are related by design. I think it becomes kind of ad hoc in light of the evidence that we see.
Yeah. Do you see you personally, where do you think God entered the picture? In other words, I was on your journey, but I'm a little bit further back. I still kind of think that the universe is old. The earth is old. Sure. But I think, I don't know, and I haven't thought as deeply as you, I'm sure, because you get grilled on this all the time. But I'm thinking that God interjected information and made special incidents of creation along the way, the Cambrian explosion, as Myers brings out and stuff, that it happened that way. But where where do you see, or do you see, the hand of God had to have come, certainly at the beginning, right? I mean, the first cell, the first replicating units. Yeah, you see the divine hand. I mean, yeah, go ahead.
So I'm open in principle to the idea that God has injected information along the way. Mm-hmm. So I see that as kind of an empirical question. Like, are there places where we see... So before I want to claim that this is like a scientific argument, I want to have the scientific data to say, yeah, there's definitely scientific data that some outside information must have been injected here. But just when I look at some of these cases, I'm just not convinced that point provides enough, has enough data associated with it. We can say, yeah, there must have been an injection at this point. So I'm agnostic about some of these points, like particularly the origin of life. That's kind of the most promising option in terms of that. That seems the largest challenge for kind of a standard naturalistic processes. But the other ones, I'm just not convinced there was actually that much information needed. Even the Cambrian explosion, where I'm not an expert, but from the reading I have done on it, I feel like, I believe there's not that much evidence of actually a bunch of new genes being required. For instance, most of the changes of ultra changes in gene regulation, which seems to require less information. But then there's like the theological question of like, is this still theologically appropriate if God is not actively intervening? You know, I think we tend not to have this theological problem when we think of other fields of science like geology or astrophysics. We don't think that God had to intervene, or I think most old earth creationists don't have models where God has to intervene at special points in history in order to create, say, the galaxy or the solar system, because we understand the laws of nature and we can model these things as processes as phenomena which developed through evolution processes.
I read one of your articles and was challenged, like, because you did talk about stellar evolution, and I don't really have a problem with that because I tend to believe in an old universe and stuff. So why do I have such a problem with biological evolution? And obviously, I'm not related to a monkey, is why I have a problem with that. You know,
right? But that's just. So I think I think it is a kind of odd inconsistency that hasn't been brought up that much. In terms of the text of Genesis, at least, like God made the stars. But we're okay with God making things through natural processes. Jesus says, I probably said in the article as well, Jesus says God feeds the birds of the air, but he does it through through ecosystems that he has in some sense designed or created. Natural law is kind of my big focus in a lot of these discussions, that I think we give the atheist too much if we let them have natural law as an atheistic explanation. The founders of modern science believe that natural law is God's law. And the reason that the universe obeys orderly, comprehensible laws is because God is the king of this universe who's established these laws, and that actually natural law is potentially even divine command, or it's a process that God has at least very specifically set up.
So do you fall into the camp of one that would believe in God as the master billiard player that sets up that first shot perfectly, and everything else just goes from there, including stellar evolution, you know, geoevolution, whatever that might be termed, and biological evolution because of that first perfectly timed shot, all the laws he set up, etc.
So I'm not sure what God's relationship is to time, but I believe that God sustains the universe, and actually I tend to have I think that natural law is maybe more active production of God. It's not just something that it's not like a clay figurine that he designed and kind of sat back and watches, but I think he really does actively sustain the universe. And the reason that natural law continues to be orderly is because of God's continual sustaining of creation.
Does he intervene in it, Zach, do you think? Rather than just making sure it doesn't fall off the tracks or whatever, did he push the evolutionary paradigm uphill the whole way to some undetectable ways?
So I'm open to that in principle, but there's not a point where I say it must have been this point, other than maybe the origin of life. Like, I'm open to that, and I actually want to look into that more. Mm-hmm. But the other points that I've looked into, they're just not that convincing as points that God must have. But so there's two separate questions. Like, is there a scientific case that God intervened at this particular point? And is there a theological principle that God does occasionally intervene? And I'm kind of agnostic on the second one, like whether we need to have intervention. I'm fully open to it. But that's quite a separate question from whether we can actually point that out scientifically.
Yeah. I mean, your common sense interpreter, the guy without a science degree, I don't know if I told you, I graduated with a biology degree back in the 80s. They probably taught, the inheritance of, Malarkey?
Lamarckianism, yeah.
Lamarckianism. I'm joking. Right. But my point is, gosh, I got so lost and then I forgot what I was talking about. For the layperson, he thinks, okay, even given, let's say that there was a E. coli or something that was just there. It just was. We won't ask where it come from. With all hands off, no divine hands in the mix, other than the laws in operation, it still startles, boggles my imagination how that could progress with random mutation, natural selection, just with those driving forces. I mean, we hear the ID camp talking about the Royal Society meeting in 2016 that supposedly came to it's really scratching their head. This is not a driving mechanism sufficient to get from A to Z.
Right. Yeah. Whenever I hear that, I kind of think there's like a bingo card that I have, or I kind of like, they always mention the Royal Society meeting and all the talk that they do, which is interesting because there's lots of Royal Society meetings. I was one at one last year on kind of a similar topic, but they don't talk about that because it wasn't, they weren't there and it wasn't on the specific topic of evolutionary theory. It's a little bit broader than that, but, the basic question is,
given a single cell, given a bacterial, how do you get from A to Z? I got a bachelor's in biology, so not a doctor like you, but from my understanding then, that was actually one of the things that brought me back. I was doing a backslidden stage at UC Irvine, and I started to, research this because, being a biology major, evolution was pushed very heavily, I thought, man, the more I looked at mutations, I went to the biomed libraries, that seems to be a dead end from all the scientific research. And so that was one of the things that took me back towards my Christian faith, besides me missing my relationship with Jesus.
So I'm sympathetic to the questions the intelligent design people are asking. And I think they're pointing out some points where kind of a really naive, kind of completely random mutation and purely natural selection actually doesn't have all the answers. And this is the kind of thing that people at the Royal Society meeting in 2016 were saying. I was actually meant to be there, but I was too late in booking and I had already all sold out. I just moved to Germany at that point and my boss was there and some others because he is also interested in this stuff. Mm-hmm.
I mean, what else is there besides purely random mutations?
So I think we're in a very special universe, and I think there are biases in mutation which turn out to be useful. So I've published a couple of papers on the structure of the genetic code. So that's the mapping between the nucleotides, the DNA letters, and the protein letters, the amino acids. It turns out that mapping is actually really special in various ways, and there's a lot of papers on this. But one way in which is special, it actually facilitates evolution. So the kind of changes that if you have a random change, if you do have a random change in a DNA sequence, it actually tends to have a much smaller effect on the protein sequence than you'd expect by chance. And that's actually exactly the kind of thing that evolution needs. Not only is it a smaller effect, but it's actually an effect that's more likely to be helpful than you'd expect by chance. And there's some papers on this you can see. If people look into my papers on the genetic code, you'll see I'm citing the other literature on this, that actually the structure of that code is built in such a way that it actually facilitates evolutionary processes. That another thing that's super relevant here is that biology is actually remarkably robust. So you can change it without killing the organism. And that allows evolution to happen, basically. So the principles of robustness and what's called evolvability are actually quite closely linked. That because something is able to be changed randomly to a small extent, that actually allows evolution to explore and to find pathways that do actually that actually allow shifting proteins from one type to another, for instance. So,
well, do you find evidence in the biosphere of random? I'll use that term, random exploration happening in organisms, and say, well, what's this? We don't know. Maybe it's going to be X-ray vision. Maybe it's going to be another limb. I mean, one of my arguments for creation is that you look at the organisms and they're fully functional. We know what all the parts do and they're beautiful. It doesn't look like the evolution's blindly reaching out in certain directions to try and find some you know, function space, if you will.
I think the fact that we, as far as we can tell from the evolutionary, the genetic evidence and the fossil evidence and such, the evolution has pursued this pathway from something like a single cell through to the complexity of the human brain and all the other complexity of modern ecosystems. I think that's remarkable. And I think that is a pointer to design.
So evolution's done its dash, huh? It's already a thing of the past. We can't observe it in the present.
No. Sorry, that wasn't my point.
Okay.
So I'm just saying that there is. So I think there's very strong evidence for common descent in the genetic, in the genetic comparison literature and the fossil record and such. But I'm saying that so you were saying biology is amazing. It's remarkable that it has stumbled across this stuff. And I say I agree with that. I actually think that is a point of design, but that doesn't, the fact it's remarkable isn't actually any evidence that it didn't happen, right?
No.
So my point is that if God designed this system, right?
Uh-huh.
If he designed this if he designed the points along the pathway such that it is actually possible to explore from the bacteria to the eukaryotic cell by the merger of the bacterial and the archaeal cell, by the introduction of various virus genes, you introduce various new features. Mm-hmm. If the system were designed such that these endpoints were possible to find through an evolutionary process, that's not evidence against an evolutionary process. And it's also not evidence against design. So I think the usual dichotomy of evolution and design is just really unhelpful because I think there's really good evidence for common descent and for this evolutionary pathway.
I think there's also good evidence for design. I don't think I stated my point well. Do you find, and you're in a field where you would, do you find that there are lots of evidences of, I'll use the term random organs, organelles in process? We don't know what they're going to be. We don't know what they are now. They don't have functions. It's evolution just reaching out in a direction that's not yet been explored. Is that the case? Or does it more seem like everything we study, whether we're studying a fish or a bacteria, you look at this and you know exactly what the function is, and you look at that and you know exactly what the function is. Which is more the case, Zach?
So I don't study organs. I study proteins. So I can talk a lot about the origin of new proteins, which is the usual intelligent design argument. So we can look at viruses, for instance. So we see they have all kinds of... So we can look at... SARS-CoV-2, the virus that caused COVID.
Yeah, you did some work on that, I saw.
Yeah, and you can see that it's related to other viruses called the family of viruses is called coronaviruses.
Yep.
But if you looked at their sequences, you actually wouldn't recognize that two proteins are related to each other. They've diverged so much, you wouldn't see. But then you see they're in the same part of the genome and they have exactly the same structure. So structures evolve a lot more slowly than sequences do. And so the fact that they have, for instance, the spike protein that one hears a lot about, the fact that all these coronaviruses have the spike protein and you can compare the sequences shows you how much evolution can happen. You can also see new genes being created and across these coronaviruses. So I don't think there's any creationist who would say that coronaviruses were kind of separately created, the different virus species within the coronavirus family. But there's so much diversity within that family. There's new proteins that have been born. There's proteins that initially look like they're separate, but if you trace the...
Slow on that. New proteins that are being born. Right. Just almost, you know, just out of out of nothing, or gene transfer, horizontal gene transfer? I mean, how are these being born?
Yeah, so a coronavirus genome is something like 30,000 base pairs.
Okay.
30,000 RNA letters, because it's an RNA virus. There's a bunch of protein-coding genes in there, but there's also regions in between those protein-coding genes, and they're evolving at quite a fast rate. And occasionally these things get translated, and they form a new protein, which didn't use, so it's a new nucleotide sequence, and that forms a new protein. There's another mechanism, which I spent a long time on, for creating new proteins, which is through overlapping genes. So because this is all quite technical, sorry for all.
I read about that. I probably understood it just because I have a little bit of a background. But that I was, like I said, I was in biology in the 80s. I think it had just been discovered, the overlapping genes and stuff, in the late 70s. So I read about that and I thought, wow. And I, from my grid, from my lens, says, wow, only God could make something read. Am I getting it right? Reading it kind of in two directions or something. That's incredible.
Yeah, so some of them are two directions. Some of them are just shifted by one or two in the same direction.
Yeah, frame
shift. So I went to work with a professor in Germany who was motivated to this because he thought there might be a design argument here. So he's a Christian who used to be a young earth creationist and shifted his views. But I was in his group as a postdoc and supervising some PhD students within his group. And we were exploring this and we were interested in, is there some kind of, how does this fit with evolution? And I'm pretty sure he'd agree with me that he came to the conclusion that these things, there's not a clear way to make a straightforward design argument for this other than from the structure of the genetic code itself, which is some of the work that I published. So the problem is that these things have ancestors. They're not just coming out of nowhere, and you can trace the ancestry of these overlapping genes. And you can show that quite recent ancestors didn't have protein coding in this overlapping region, but then something, a small mutation happened and it converted to a protein coding gene. I think the assumption that proteins are like these all these amazing molecular machines, like the things I have behind me, is actually not true. There's a lot of proteins that are very short and they're not necessarily doing that much. And that's how proteins seem to be born, and they seem to evolve over time. So yeah, this is a massive topic.
It seems almost that maybe because you're bathed in it and you work in it every day, that to me, when I read about your overlapping genes and frame shift reading that's accurate, I thought, man, it just screams intelligence to me. It screams like, how could this have possibly happened?
So
the powers of nature, I don't know.
Would one be saying that the God designed the all the different coronaviruses that each has their own different overlapping genes, and these were each created separately, even though we can see they definitely look like they're related to it? So this is where the issue comes in, that it's actually, it may seem, I fully agree. The boss I was working with, was inspired in this direction, thinking maybe there's some kind of design argument here. But we worked through it and think, actually, maybe the design's at a deeper level. And that's the message I try and communicate in my evolution by design work, is actually, I think this design and maybe the structure of the genetic code, which is a fundamental kind of basis of life. I think this design and what's called the genotype-phenotype map. So this is the mapping between all possible sequences and all possible protein structures. I think that mapping had to be set up nicely in order for evolution to work. This is stuff I'm kind of working on. But I really don't see evidence that God is kind of intervening to create separate species, because they just seem so clearly related to each other. It seems very non-parsimonious and kind of odd that God is creating stuff that's just remarkably similar to what was there so soon prior. This is similar to the evolution of languages, I think, is another nice analogy. English and Dutch, English and German, they're all related to each other. Not immediately obvious once you go a little bit further, but the other European languages are also related to each other through basically an evolutionary process. And these kind of, this hierarchical kind of branching process is, I think, very similar to the pattern that we see in genetics. That is pretty good evidence for common ancestry.
So you're on the cutting edge of the field, because some of the stuff that I read, and I don't pour myself into this all the time, but just that the claims are, well, just as Darwin predicted lots of transitional fossils being dug up, and they by and large haven't. Well, even the genetic picture is quite scattered, lacking, sometimes contradictory and whatnot. Is that an overstatement? Is that a misstatement? A false statement?
Well, people...
That genetics don't give us a very clear pathway of family trees and stuff. Is that a matter of interpretation or just false or outdated information or what?
I think it's complicated, basically, but I think overall the genetic evidence is very clear for common ancestry. It's not that every individual gene gives you exactly the same tree, and it's similar to if we study the different words in English and German. If you try to trace each of the evolution, it's messy, right? Like history is messy. Languages are messy. Biology turns out to be messy because of this thing called horizontal gene transfer, but also other processes, incomplete lineage sorting, where things don't evolve at the same rate as you'd expect. Genes don't all, particularly when you have sexually reproducing organisms and you get recombination, it's very complicated. It's not just bacteria that I usually work with. I was going to say they're simpler, but actually in this case, they're even worse in that they have even more horizontal gene transfer. So there is messiness, but then there's also things that you would expect to be not horizontally transferred, like the ribosome. And it turns out that when you focus on, say, ribosomal genes or some of these other core genes, you actually get a very nice tree. So if you think about what should be the case from first principles, and another technical example is called this... the genes and for division and cell wall, a DCW gene cluster. So these are involved in the division of the bacteria. And so this is like a key process which is very very well conserved across very diverse bacteria across billions of years. And these things actually form a really nice phylogenetic tree, which is consistent with the tree that you get if you look at the ribosomal proteins. So it's not that it's complicated, and it would kind of take me probably a few hours of kind of like tutorial for most of the listeners who don't have much biology background
to really
step through what I see as the evidence for common ancestry from the genetic perspective. But those who study it, who come into this with anti-evolutionary kind of position, in my experience, overwhelmingly shift towards a more evolution-friendly position. So I know multiple people with PhDs in molecular biology who started very skeptical of evolution and shifted. And, you know, someone might say I was just the peer pressure around them or...
What do you say of that?
Well, I think that's just... I think that's kind of condescending towards my colleagues and myself, and who are like serious Christians who are motivated by Christian beliefs and values about the importance of truth and the importance of treating evidence carefully. And actually, if anything, we're very motivated the other direction. We're very motivated not to accept common ancestry given the things that we were told.
Sure.
And just again and again, quite independently. I mean, not fully independently because we're all part of the same community, but independently in our own thinking processes, focusing on this area of evolution or this area, find the evidence really strong. My area has been molecular genetics, but other people, you know, study the fossil record or such. I think it's also, I mean, I've got lots of things to say about this, but one thing that's also important is many of the intelligence design biologists accept common ancestry. Probably most of the big names. So Gunter Bechli, who sadly died, earlier this year.
I did not know that. Okay.
He was good friends with my boss, Siegfried, who I was working with in Munich. Michael Denton, who was initially working in New Zealand, who really started the intelligence line movement, his book, Evolution, A Theory in Crisis. Michael Behe. Various others I probably shouldn't name because I think their views are not public, but a number of the intelligent design people, probably I would say most of their senior biologists, are actually either very sympathetic to common ancestry or accept it. So The idea that, oh, there's such a mess and all the evidence is against it, or so. Actually, even the people who are skeptical of neo-Darwinian processes and are Christians and, you know, take the label intelligent design, a large number of them are actually accept common ancestry. So it's not as, I think the case for it is pretty strong. And yeah. It's strong enough to convince these people and others.
They would accept common ancestry, but they believe what? If they're in the ID movement, what are they?
Information okay. is in, well, some of it's such a broad tent.
I'm sure. What are some of the options?
That's so basically that information is injected.
That's kind of what I come to. But I thought I really re-examined my view, and I thought, okay, I'm going to get on here with Zach, and I believe that God injected information at spurts in really distinct areas of time. Maybe Zach believes, or some believe, that God injected information at the micro level at every minute along the way. Are we really that different? I don't know. You know, I don't know where you fall in that. That God didn't.
Yes, I'm not sure that God is. So another analogy I don't think I mentioned yet is the analogy of history. So like the history of the people of Israel, you step back and look at that, it's super messy, but there are some kind of threads through that reading with a kind of canonical reading of scripture or a Jesus-focused reading of scripture, we can see all kinds of stuff that was kind of designed in that process. But I think we can still, or even just the secular history, there's all kinds of interesting things that happen in history, but history is super messy. But the Christian belief is that God is providentially in charge of that system, despite its apparent messiness and despite the fact it doesn't seem to be going anywhere. So if evolution looks messy, that's not a problem for God, because history also looks messy, and Christians have never found that a problem for believing that God is providentially in charge of history.
Yeah,
I think there's actually evidence in evolutionary processes that it's not quite as messy as some people have thought. There's this kind of spectrum belief among mainstream evolution biologists, from Stephen Jay Gould, the late Harvard paleontologist, who kind of, at least early in his career, emphasized the complete randomness of evolution. If you rewound the tape of life, as he put it, it would end up in a completely different place.
Right.
Through to others like Simon Conrad Morris, who's here in Cambridge, who happens to be a Christian, who thinks that evolution is much more law-like and much less random. And there's others in that boat. Actually, the field has shifted more towards Simon Conrad Morris's view, I think, over the last few decades.
And he believes in a what did he say convergent evolution, that we've converged on the site and stuff several times. So it was, man was inevitable, basically. Do you agree with that?
Yes, so I'm sympathetic to some of this kind of stuff. That basically evolution's more law-like than some people like Stephen Jay Gould have thought. But theologically, I think it doesn't matter, because history is super messy and might look super contingent rather than super determined. But it's still, God's still providentially in charge. What is useful is if it turns out to be more law-like than kind of stuff.
So I guess let me pause you for a second, because you've tweaked my thinking yet again. Do I believe God is sovereignly in control of history? Yes. Yeah. Is that readily apparent? Not sometimes. Sometimes it seems to be working very behind the scenes, you know? Sometimes his ways are certainly mysterious in that. But I believe in the book of Revelation, that I believe that in the end, this, that, and the other is going to happen. So is God behind what seems to be a chaotic or random process of history? That's a good one, Zach.
Right. It's also similar to what I said before with meteorology, that actually you can study these processes through like dynamical systems or chaos theory or whatever. I'm not a physicist. I don't know what they do, but I'm told that you can study this stuff, and it in some sense it looks, you know, random, but that's not a problem for God. So that's not for me, the interesting question is whether you is still appointed to design in that process. So in history, it's actually hard to find pointers of design. In meteorology, it's hard to find pointers of design. I think it'd be irresponsible to do that, maybe. But in biology, because of things like Simon Conrad Morris's convergent evolution, and because of things like what I take to be the remarkable design of the genetic code and the kind of initial conditions of life, so both the initial conditions of life, the processes of life, the way that evolution works and has these biases in it that promote the production of new proteins and things, and the way that organisms seem to be related to each other, such that it is possible. So Richard Dawkins talks about climbing Mount Improbable.
Uh-huh.
And I think one of the interesting things there is, let's say he's right about the evolutionary process. I think It's still remarkable that there is this mountain with the smooth pathway up it that can be climbed. And that's the world I think we live in, basically, that there is this pathway from single-celled organism through to the human brain. And Dawkins says, oh, look, there's a pathway, therefore you don't need God. I would say, oh, there's a pathway, but there's no reason there should have been a pathway from first principles of biology or physics. The fact we live in this universe that is life-permitting is evidence of fine-tuning, but it's also evolution-permitting, and that's like an extra level of fine-tuning, I would say. So hopefully that argument makes sense.
Well, where do you what about humans being made, you know, imago Dei, in the image of God? What does that mean to you? How did that occur? I mean, some people say, well, yeah, there were hominids around, Neanderthals, and then God divinely created, de novo created Adam and Eve or whatever. I mean, how does that work out for you? What does it mean to be in the image of God? Unique, special, or are we just like the chimps and orangutans, only a little more evolved? Lucky us.
Yeah, I think there's basically probably like 10 different questions in there, which is hard to unpick. But so I don't have a particular model. Like I kind of change my view on this every week or so, because partly because
that's
the
fair.
Science. Yeah, the science is the science changes actually, you know, again, this is not my area, but it changes over the course of a few years. Like, you know, they keep finding new fossils, or the way that we interpret the genetics in terms of population sizes in the past changes, and it's a very actively developing field. I have written some stuff about this, and people can, I'll probably put a link to this on my website at some point that people can look up. But there's a few options. So I think there are good theological reasons to think there was some kind of Adam and Eve. But
literal.
Yeah.
Okay.
But there's different points in the story in which you can place them. So William Lane Craig places them something like, I think, 700,000 years ago, maybe, with the origin of, I think it's Homo heidelbergensis. I might be getting that wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Either that or Homo I think heidelbergensis is his favored. So relatively ancient Adam and Eve. Or you can have a more recent Adam and Eve, but they're not the ancestor of everyone. And I kind of changed, there's pros and cons of both of those views. Also, there's the old earth creationist, the young earth creationist, there's probably 10 or 20 different schools of thoughts among them as to how we make the fossil record and the genetics fit with some kind of literal Adam and Eve. This is a messy area. And as soon as you try and engage the science, which is changing, and I think scripture doesn't place as many constraints as some people do on the picture that we try and build, there's questions that scripture leaves open, like where did Cain get his wife from? Who are the Nephilim? Kind of notorious question.
Yes.
And there's not really clear answers to these questions.
Yeah, I always felt guilty asking you about it. I mean, especially since you're, you know, a molecular biologist. but I
right.
anyways.
So basically, I'm aware of the range of options, and I'm kind of comfortable like shifting my view back and forth as I read more stuff on it. And I think this is generally the case with science and faith discussions, actually. That we have models, as we do in science, we have models of integrating science and faith, of integrating theology and science. And those models can shift as the data shifts or as our interpretation shifts.
Yeah. It's hard to try and find something, you know, like a guts of both theology and biology, you know, to get them all together, because they fall short in different areas. And like you say, science is an evolving field where we find new, you know, make new finds and whatnot. So yeah, I'm not sure at all where I stand on those issues, you know, and it's one of those things where I tend to vacillate as well. Even, you know, you read young earth creation stuff as you're reading it, that makes sense. Wow, what a good argument. And then you read some of the refutations of it. Oh, okay. So I don't know.
Right. Yeah, and everyone, basically everyone has a different view on this, actually, if you really get into the weeds. Sure. If you pick five different intelligent design proponents, I could name various people who all have slightly different views on this. So I'm not, often this is kind of leveraged as like a critique of theistic evolution. And I think that's just not fair. Because
Hence when I ask you, it's just, what's your personal idea? Because I surely don't have mine fully formulated. Do you personally tend to, so obviously they're in the Adam and Eve would be in the evolutionary lineage of previous hominids, but what God breathed his spirit into those two directly, you think, or what do you think?
So it could have been a fairly significant remodeling of the genome. You know, that would be like the strong case. Like,
okay.
So then it would still show evidence of common ancestry, but there was a significant change. So maybe like there's the fusion of, but this is stuff that's controversial. I probably shouldn't say in public, but there could be like a remodeling, like a genetic engineering that would be like a strong interventionist case that still maintains common ancestry. Or it could be that there's just a really minor change. The biological difference is really not much, but God is in relationship with these people. So that would be if we have like the very ancient Adam and Eve that I'm quite sympathetic to. But then I'm also sympathetic to the idea that there's a difference between like Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 in terms of God creates humanity in Genesis 1. But maybe there's a difference between that and God creating Adam in Genesis 2. Because there's theologians like John Walton, I think, or at least some others who've commented on the text, make quite a bit out of this distinction between humanity and Adam. Adam being like a representative, but not necessarily the same as God creating humanity in Genesis 1. That would maybe be a way to kind of leave room for the later creation of Adam within the earlier created humanity. So I'm not sure. I see pros and cons of various perspectives on this.
That's fair.
But I think there is theological reason to think that there was an Adam and Eve, the first people with whom God was in relationship.
Yeah, that's fair. What about the people like Jacques Benaud, who makes the claim that natural selection is kind of a cruel, eliminative process, and that it's morally inconsistent to claim that a loving God used it to create? How might you respond to that if Jacques were still alive?
Yeah, so this is where I think the recent developments in evolutionary theory are kind of interesting, that I think there's a shift away from that earlier view, which was also held by Richard Dawkins, particularly, that natural selection is really the only thing worth talking about in evolution. Uh-huh. I think natural selection is just one minor part of, I mean, it's important, but it's often overstated, its case. So the idea that a lot of people say, well, like death is intrinsic to the evolutionary process, I'd say that technically that's not really right. Like, even on the strict natural selection view, evolution is about differential reproduction. And death is not really actually the core part of that process. It's really just that some mutations enable a faster population growth than others. So it's not about death. And I think with the recent developments in what's called the extended evolutionary synthesis, it's not really about natural selection either. As the only thing driving it. So I think these mutational biases are really important in evolution. I think the whole field is called evo-devo, so the relationship between development and evolution, which is also a kind of like bias that's built into the process. That's also what drives the major changes. There's a lot of mainstream evolution biologists who kind of really downplay natural selection as the major factor.
But doesn't that take one of the major tools away, the driving forces?
Yeah, well, it's replace it with other things, with the biases in evolution, and with the, I see it as kind of a structuralist view. So the importance of things like organismal body plan, and basically the way that body plans are related to each other is actually really important for evolution. So the Richard Dawkins perspective is that natural selection can do anything, that mutation is completely random, and natural selection is what really hones things onto their specific functions. Whereas a more structuralist view of evolution is that there's underlying laws, like Simon Conway Morris would say, and that drive things. And the way that, this is all quite technical, so I'm trying to explain that way that's like understandable. But basically, the way the organisms are built due to the underlying biophysics and the underlying developmental processes, that's actually more important. Like the fact that some organismal forms are able to evolve to others because they're really, you only need small genetic changes to switch from one to the other. That kind of whole arrangement of evolutionary space, that's way more important than natural selection. And I see that fitting quite nicely with kind of an underlying design plan that God has set up. Some people use the metaphor of a library with lots of books in it. And there's a pathway through that library, which produces the amazing things we see. And that requires design, I think, that there would be such a pathway through that library. But I feel like
that requires design. Did you say that word? The D word?
Yeah. I've said it quite a few times in this conversation. So my framework really is like evolution by design. So that's why I'm a little cautious of the word like theistic evolution or evolution creation, because a lot of those people would really say, oh, no, you can't talk about design because that's what creationists do. I think there's an underlying design plan, and that's why evolution works. But I think that's not problematic from a scientific perspective, because I'm really open on what the processes were. Like, I'm trying to explore what specific processes were involved, and I'll change my hypotheses on how that design was implemented. But I'm pretty convinced that there needed to be an underlying design plan to make evolution work, in the same way that there's an underlying design plan for stellar evolution to work, as we said before.
Sure. How do you answer? You've seen it, I'm sure. You're on the university campus. Sometimes you and your wife go there and do talks and whatnot. And you see the young, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, homeschooled, young earth creationist kid. And he asks you, well, did we evolve from the apes? And is evolution true? You know, it's a major worldview shift. How do you handle that?
Yeah,
regardless of true or not. I mean, that's just, you could smash someone's worldview.
Yeah, I think just starting gently with the age of the Earth is where I tend to go. Like, and there's a lot of young earth creationists who are not read. I mean, it's not, they're not that fussed about the age of the Earth. It's just, I think scripturally, like, there's just very little reason to hold to. So there's a theological argument which is stronger, which is about death before sin. That's the key argument.
Yeah.
In terms of the length of the days and the actual the basic outline of Genesis and such, there's just very little reason to hold to a young earth. There's hints within the text that this is not literal, the highly structured form. The first 3 days are creating realms, the next 3 days are filling those realms. The fact God creates the sun on day four, that we define a day according to the sun. So what were the first 3 days if there wasn't a sun? The fact the seventh day seems to be a continuing day. I think Jesus teaches this when he talks about the Sabbath. And he says that in the Hebrews, it says we can enter God's rest.
That's not a modern interpretation, is it? Claimed.
Right. So this has been known since the, before the New Testament, that Philo was writing, ancient Jewish writer, was giving some kind of I actually have a thick book I need to finish reading on all the different ways that Genesis has been interpreted over the last few centuries. Yeah. And there's all kinds of non-literal interpretations, and it's not a response to Darwin. So that's a good place to start, I think. Once someone's there, then they're much more open to what science has to say, I think. And I'm not worried about whether someone accepts Darwinian evolution or not, other than providing space for them if they're going to study biology. I don't want the biology professor to really trouble their faith, as I guess my first couple of evolutionary professors did.
Because how do you handle it with it? I mean, do you teach lecture halls and whatnot, or do you get in front of students very often?
Yes, I am not teaching the kind of big first year classes at Yeah, so I'm just teaching kind of small master's courses on kind of fairly niche topics.
Okay.
But I mean, I'd like to kind of introduce a little bit more accurate history of science, for instance. So a lot of biology 101 lectures will kind of basically say that everyone was dealing with creationists, and then Darwin came along and destroyed it, and basically Christianity is stupid. Like, that's basically what my first couple of evolutionary biology professors said. Like, they had an agenda which was anti-Christian, and just the history is just wrong there, that people were old earth creationists before Darwin came along. In the decades before Darwin, the age of the earth was not as seen as it. Yeah. So Charles Spurgeon has a sermon, I think, and maybe some writings, maybe a decade or so before Darwin's, where he says, so this was the main, even for a very conservative Baptist like Charles Spurgeon, the mainstream evangelical view was, yeah, okay, the earth looks to be old because of gap theory would be one interpretation, that there's a gap between the first two verses of Genesis 1. There are other interpretations as well that were being offered as people were discovering the age of the universe. People would actually, for a couple of centuries before Darwin, for a couple of centuries before Darwin, people were discovering.
No, I didn't know that. I thought it was, the story I heard was Charles Lyell with his gradualism came a few decades before.
Right.
And that paved the way type of thing.
Right. But, yeah, so there was Lyell, but there were Christians involved in that as well. So one of them is Adam Sedgwick, who is a Cambridge geologist, and there's a Sedgwick Museum here in Cambridge based on his geology. He taught Darwin geology. He took Darwin on field trips in Wales, and he was he was an evangelical and a reverend. He was a priest in the Church of England. And a geology professor in Cambridge, and he taught Darwin geology, and this was, of course, the decades before Darwin wrote his major work.
Yeah.
And so him and various others, so he was professor in Cambridge, and the professor in Oxford was William Buckland, I think, who was also a Christian, and writing about the interpretation of Genesis from a non young earth creationist view. Various scientists even in the late 1600s were starting to discover that there's reason to think that Noah's flood maybe wasn't global, and these fossils look like they're a lot older than the pyramids, which were the oldest buildings that were known at the time. So people were, the idea the earth is old was starting to be mainstream among scientists, and of course a large proportion of these scientists were Christians well before Darwin came along. It wasn't just the kind of more secular people like Lyell who are pushing this.
Mm. Do you, as we kind of tend to, we're going to land the plane in just a minute here. How hard did you struggle? Did your faith struggle at all through these transitions, young earth creationist to an old earth creationist to a progressive, a theistic evolution, whatever you might say? Did that knock your faith? Was your faith ever in jeopardy through your journey, Zach?
So in my first year of uni, it was, for sure. And that was a mix of things, the shift to university, new environment, new people, very strong atheist professors in biology, no one around me who was super academic or particularly in the sciences. So I really thought, oh, no one has thought about this stuff. Which was stupid, but when you're 18 and you come across something new, and then the head of the biology department, who's fellow of the Royal Society of New Zealand, very important person who everyone really respected, was quite anti-Christian in his lectures. And the guy who was specifically teaching biology was also quite anti-Christian, specifically teaching evolutionary biology, was quite anti-Christian in his lectures. And so that kind of forced me to do a lot of reading and to read a lot of the creationist stuff, actually. And that was challenging. Helped me develop my faith, I guess. I got baptized at the end of my first year of university, kind of deciding, I think I am a Christian. I should actually say this publicly. So that was helpful in its own way. And it has kind of shifted me into apologetics more as well. So
yeah. Have you had any of the pushback that we read about, you know, that somebody say they're a Christian, oh, all of a sudden they're going to lose their job or they lose respect amongst their peers. Have you experienced that in your academic professional career?
I think it's different in the States, that the States is just more partisan and more polarized in various ways. Not just, I mean, of course, recently, but also it's been that way for quite a while around evolution. Much less so in the UK. In New Zealand, when I was just in that period, when I was doing my undergrad, which is 2008 to 2012, that was kind of the peak of the new atheist movement. And the biology department at Auckland was very keen on Richard Dawkins. And so it wasn't, I was worried actually when I started my PhD. So I worked with a professor who happened to be agnostic because I thought that's a safe person to work with compared with the very strong atheists.
Yeah.
But I think that that has shifted even in New Zealand and elsewhere. So I really haven't got that kind of negative pushback. You hear negative things, but only when people don't realize that there's Christians in the room. So if you're sitting at a conference table after dinner, at dinner or something, and people will make anti-Christian comments because they just assume that it's a secular space, which is an opportunity to... I ask a question and that changes the people realize.
Changes your tenor. Okay.
Yeah, it changes the tone a lot. So that's always interesting.
It would be.
I gave a talk in my institute a couple of years ago because there's a Christian group at my institute and we occasionally run events. And so, you know, some of my colleagues were there and heard it and they didn't think it's stupid. They thought it was quite interesting actually. And so I didn't lose my job from that.
Was there ever a danger? Were you worried about it before the talk?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, good on you. That's being bold. Come on.
Being an academic is a tenuous job. So it's possible someone will listen to this or to something else I've said and decide, oh, he's a bit too controversial. But I think overall, there's really not. I think that the tone has shifted a lot from the Richard Dawkins era.
It seems like it. Yeah. In a good way. Good. Well, listen. Yeah. If there's anything that you look back on this and say, I'd rather you edit that out. Just let us know. Let me know.
No, I think it's okay.
Okay. I know you caught yourself. Stopped yourself once. And so, listen, are there any questions or topics? I know we've gone a little over an hour, but it's fascinating to me anyway with my background. Anything that you wish we'd have discussed or you thought I would discuss or whatever that we've missed? There's 101 things we could have talked about, but anything you kind of say, hey, what about this?
Yeah, not really. I think I said basically everything. Mostly I like to emphasize that the laws of nature are God's laws. And I think that basic understanding of we live in a world which is orderly and intelligible because it has a rational creator. That actually provides like a basis for science. It actually means it's fully natural for Christians to study science. It's a fully legitimate Christian endeavor. And it can help Christians relax about science. And it can sometimes open up people who aren't Christian to considering Christian faith as well.
Yeah. Very good. Well, thank you very much, Zach, for being on the show. You've provided a lot of insight and, you know, I've heard it from the horse's mouth. I've never really spoken to somebody that was in your camp, but it's been good and I appreciate it. And so, listen, make sure you subscribe to the Ziggy Matters podcast where you're going to get more interesting guests and we'll probe some difficult questions. And if you want to know more about Zach and his work and do some of his readings, you got a website, www.zacharyardern.com. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, find you there. Okay, thanks for listening. Thanks, Zach. God bless.
For more reasons why we believe,
or to support this ministry, go to
thinkingmatters.org.nz.